3 minute like class, and so we were live streaming for like a good amount of time, but we found, based on our marketing and research analysts here at the Manhattan Jewish Experience, that if we do too much live streaming, not enough people actually show up in person. So what we're doing is, so people who can't come, we're going to do the old little tape recorder. And so if anyone, whatever, you would like to share this with, that missed class, couldn't be here for whatever reason, it is being recorded, and we upload it to YU Torah, which has literally hundreds of thousands of classes, if anybody's interested. That's like a real number. It's Yeshiva University's, what do you call it? Database of just Torah classes and insights and all that. So I was going to actually begin tonight with the topic of our mission, but I think that I want to jump to next week's topic first and come back to mission next week. I'll tell you in a minute why. Because our topic next week is about failing. Now, do I really want to start like a new semester off talking about failing? What's that? Professors do it all the time. So, but I thought about this, that that one of the things that really keeps us, and this is the reason why I want to begin tonight with this particular topic, and I took this this title from another author who wrote a book called Failing Forward. It's a really amazing piece. Because failing and the fear of not living up to whatever it is that we set our minds to do, whatever it is we think our mission is in life, often gets in the way of really realizing our aspirations, our hopes, and our goals in life. And this little mini semester, it's called The New Year, New You. So we're dealing with failure, finding your mission, and practicing discipline. They're all actually interconnected. The last topic is the means through which that we can actually find the mission. But I want to begin tonight with the idea of, with Judaism's, I think, unique perspective on failure. Because I think it could really help us forge forward on whatever mission that we decide we want to pursue in life. Oh, Daniel, thank you. So I'm going to start out with something very personal, which was very embarrassing to me for many years. And I guess I shared it with enough people that it's no longer embarrassing. I'm hoping this is still recording. Yeah. So I come from a big family of lawyers. Just everyone in my family are lawyers, like everybody. my dad has been, he's retired now, but he practiced literally for almost 60 years. My brother is an attorney. My sister-in-law is a lawyer. All my cousins are lawyers. When we get together for family, they're not fun get-togethers. They're just lots of lawyers sitting in a room with you. I'm just kidding about that. Anyway, so years ago, it was sort of like expected. Even if you don't practice law, you go to law school. It's a good training. You never know what you'll do with it. And I went to law school. I combined it with some other interests of mine as well. And it was time to take the bar. And I took it. And I'll never forget the day that I received the results in that letter from the New York bar examiners came in the mail. And I was so excited. I was going to join the ranks of my family, whether I was going to practice or not, whatever. I opened up the letter, and I failed. I failed. Now, no one in my family ever failed the bar. And it wasn't even something I considered. I don't know, maybe I'm too much of a snob. And I definitely took on too much. I was in rabbinical school at the same time. I was also in a master's program in international affairs. But I thought I could do it, and I thought I was juggling everything. And I remember this huge pit in my stomach. And I remember not wanting anyone else to know. I was humiliated. But I wasn't deterred yet. I'll sign up for a different bar review course. I'll study harder. I'll be more disciplined in terms of the things I take on. I remember at the time I was very involved with Soviet jury, and then somebody got me involved with Ethiopian jury at the same time. and I was packing boxes for Ethiopian Jews every Sunday in Brooklyn. And then I'm like, I'm going to cut that out. No more clothing for Ethiopian Jews anymore. I got to pass the Fakakta bar. And so I took it again. I paid a ton of money for another bar review course. And I got the results back. And guess what? Yeah, I failed again. Twice. And at this point, I felt like a total failure. And I said, I'm not doing this again. This is just too painful. And there was no way that I was going to put myself through that experience and have other people be aware of it, too. So I'm sharing this story because fear of failure is a major impediment to lots of people, particularly young people. I'll give you some statistics from reaching their life goals and dreams. And I see it every day with my students, how fear of failure can prevent us from achieving, you know, small goals, big goals. It could be staying on a diet. It could be taking on a new project at work or pursuing an important relationship because we got burnt in the last one. And we become so hesitant, we don't open ourselves up. And we know the relationship can't go anywhere unless we do that, but we're afraid. We don't want to fail again. And today, this fear of failure is affecting younger people more than ever. The Wall Street Journal reported on a study that concluded that startup companies by 20-somethings are at their lowest in the last, I would say, quarter of a century, last 25 years. It was down from, this study was done back in 2013, it was down from 10% in 1989 to 3% in 2013, which means that the population most suited to risk-taking in America, young 20s, without mortgages and kids' tuition to pay. Okay, student loans, fine, I got it. Okay, good point. Still unaccountable to spouses, children, mortgages, okay? The lowest risk takers. Do you know what the highest risk taking age group in the United States is today? People my age and up, 50 and up. And the question is, what wisdom can Judaism offer about failure to overcome this fear? And to really persevere in the face of challenge, especially when we're afraid that that failure is going to prevent us from moving on and really embarking on an important relationship or career path. So I want to share some Torah, some ideas from Judaism. And it's one of the most profound teachings that, you know, sometimes a little extra letter or word in the Bible, in the Torah, seems out of place or superfluous, and we can learn so much. It's a very famous teaching that when God finished creating on the first day, literally creating the world, the Torah in the book of Genesis says, Vayehi Erev, Vayehi Boker, and it was evening, and it was morning. That's where we get the idea that the Jewish day starts at night, because it starts, and it was evening, and it was morning, Yom Echad, day one. And what's the problem? Can anybody find... So very subtle. And it was evening and it was morning, day one. Every word in the Torah, every letter, teaches something. So the rabbis ask, what is extra in that verse? The word and, which is just one letter in Hebrew, vet, avav. Vayehi, erev, vayehi, and it was. And always implies what?
Something before.
What came before the first day of creation? There was nothing before. And the rabbis of the Midrash teach, is a very famous teaching, the Melamed, to teach that God created hundreds of worlds before He created the world in which we exist, Vehechrivan, and He destroyed all of them until He ended up with the world He wanted. Which is kind of like a strange teaching. God couldn't have gotten it right on the first try. You know, like, there was like some poem when I was a kid, I remember it was like, you know, God doesn't need an eraser on his pencil. God doesn't make mistakes. What is the idea that God created all these worlds? And some people, by the way, I'm doing, in a couple of weeks, by the way, my podcast, I'm going to be interviewing three rabbis who are also cosmologists, physicists, about the age of the universe. And interestingly, some like to use this midrash to reconcile the age of the universe with the Torah. Right? Most cosmologists believe the world is, 13, 14 billion years old, and the Torah seems to say it's 5,700. Well, there were hundreds of worlds before. It's not one of the better answers, honestly, but some suggest this. But it's a strange teaching. But the simple answer is that by creating and destroying, it's not like God needed to keep perfecting, but he's teaching us something. He's teaching us not to give up when something does not come out the right way on the first, second, or even third try. The great line from the famous inventor Thomas Edison, when he was once asked by a reporter with some chutzpah, how did it feel to fail so many times when he was trying to invent the alkaline battery? And anybody remember the answer? It's a famous line from Thomas Edison. He says, I never failed once. I just found the 9,000 ways that it won't work. And he reframed failure as a necessary prerequisite to success. And that's the way I believe Judaism looks at failure. It doesn't even have really that word. It's just the process you have to go through in order to eventually get to where you want to go. There's a great Hasidic master, Reb Levi of Berdichev. He taught that one of the things that an adult can learn from a baby is that no matter how many times a baby, while it's trying to learn how to walk, falls down, just keeps getting up. I mean, you ever watch like a cute little, pudgy baby just like waddling all over the place and just looks like a drunk person, falls down, gets up, and at some point you're like, doesn't the kid learn? Just stay down. It's not working. But somehow the child naturally intuits that in order to eventually walk, it has to just keep falling and getting up, falling and getting up. So if falling or failing is really the way that we humans learn, even as from a small children, then why does it feel so bad? Why is there still a stigma when we fail? We try to take off the stigma and people make you feel better, but there is. And if it's the way we learn, and it's so embedded within our tradition that even God had to fail a bunch of times before he created the world, then like, what is it that makes us feel so miserable? Because if we can get over the misery, I think we would take more chances. We wouldn't be as afraid to start something new or different. And to answer this question, I want to take you back to the very beginning, to the Garden of Eden. And because there's so much wisdom and so much to be learned about the way we were created from that story. So you're all familiar with it, I'm sure. There's only two people there, Adam and Eve. Okay? God said, enjoy. It's all yours. Except, what did he tell them? Don't eat the fruit from the Eitz Hadat, from the tree of knowledge. And of course they did. Right? Adam blamed it on Eve. It's her fault. She told me to do it. Who did Eve blame it on? The snake. The snake, the cunning serpent, right, was able to convince Eve that it was okay. Now, that original sin is what the religionists call it. The first sin, right, which caused them to be banished from the Garden of Eden and for God to have to change everything, okay? That original sin, according to Christianity, so tainted, and this is a very famous teaching, and I'm sure many of us are familiar with it. We grew up in a country which is very influenced by Christian teachings. That original sin, according to Christianity, so tainted man that humankind becomes incapable of saving itself. And this is where you have the famous doctrine of Catholic doctrine of called original sin. Now that story was in our Bible. That's in the Hebrew scripture, what we call the Old Testament. We believe that story took place, but we have a different understanding of the impact of that original sin. According to Christianity, that original sin completely prevents people from saving themselves. And that's why Christianity to this day teaches that if you want to be saved, if you want to save your soul, you have to place your faith in a being that was not tainted by that original sin. Which is why Jesus is believed to have been born of immaculate conception, because sex, the church continues to teach, is the means through which that original sin is perpetuated and carried on through the ages. Now, what's the Jewish view? The Jewish view is very different. It's the same story, okay? But we believe that it had a different impact. According to Judaism, specifically Kabbalah, Jewish mystical tradition, Adam and Eve, before they sinned, were on a very high spiritual level. They were almost like angels. And there was evil in the world. There was physicality in even the world. It wasn't within human beings. Adam and Eve were almost like these angelic beings that possessed only a good inclination. Now you can ask them what led them to sin, the temptation, whatever. But within them, there was nothing really that was bad. What Kabbalah teaches happened when they ate, when they disobeyed God, was that they took the bad that was out there, external to man. Anybody know what it was represented by? What symbolized evil or bad negativity in the world then? So it's either the fruit itself or the serpent. But it was there, it existed, but it was external to man. When man and women, Adam and Eve, brought that in, now we changed. We don't become incapable of saving ourselves like the Christians believe, but we become a lot more complicated. We now have what's called a Yetzer Tov in Hebrew and a Yetzer Hara, a good inclination and a evil inclination. We have a part of us that really wants to connect with something higher and greater and be involved in what we consider to be the moral good. And there's also a part of us that's very drawn to the physical and to the base, and that's animal. They're both of us within us. And it's complicated. And that's why we have these struggles. You know, and I don't mean like, you know, should I have the sushi or the pizza? I mean like we have moral and ethical struggles. But we do believe that the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination, can prevail over the Yetzer Hara, over the negative inclination. Now, this distinction between Christianity and Judaism is fundamental, and I think this is the most important distinction. It's not whether you believe in Jesus, you don't believe in Jesus. It's this point. And it's expressed in who you think the Mashiach is. Let's think about it for a minute. Who is the Messiah in Christianity? Who is the Messiah in Judaism? Now you're probably wondering, what the heck does this have to do with failure? I'm going to come back to it, okay? So in Christianity, I mentioned it before, the Messiah is Jesus, right? And he has to come back. They believe in a second coming in order to be able to finish up the work he hasn't done initially. So he's born of Immaculate Conception. According to Catholicism, even Jesus' mother, Mary, is born free of original sin. He's perfect. And he needs to be perfect because you and I cannot perfect ourselves. We're just simply incapable of it. Original sin has so tainted us that we need to place our faith in someone that was not subject to this sin and that can save us because we can't do it ourselves. Judaism? Who's the Mashiach in Judaism? We don't really talk about the Messiah so much, Jews. Christians talk about it a lot. I mean, maybe if you're Lubavitch, you talk about it a lot. But who's our Mashiach? Well, all right. Well, so we don't know who he is, right? But we know he's supposed to come from who?
Descendant
of the Davidic dynasty of David. Okay, interesting. Now, David was a great prophet. He was also a great poet and warrior, very complex individual. But he's by no means depicted in the prophets. If you've studied anything about David, as this picture perfect individual, he is no Jesus, so to speak. He's a great prophet, and he's a righteous person, but he was involved in some pretty serious stuff, okay? He also had enemies. He had Jewish enemies, Shaul HaMelech. He had non-Jewish enemies, the Philistines. He struggled with sin. If you're familiar with the whole incident with Bathsheba, he had enormous challenges and obstacles in his life. But he taught us something very, very profound. That even though we struggle and we have that side of us, you can rise above your failures and you can rise above your sins. You can save yourself by doing what we call in Hebrew, tshuva. What's tshuva? Tshuva means returning to your best possible self with the help of Torah and mitzvot. And if you don't believe that, then you need a savior. Then you got to place your faith in someone who's perfect to rescue you. And I like to put this in superhero terms, because I'm a big superhero lover. Okay, so who's the closest thing we have to the Christian concept of Mashiach or the Jewish concept of Mashiach? So I like using Superman and Batman, because if you think about it, Superman, and by the way, in some of the Superman movies, he's very, you know, when he there's always like this glow around him. He never says anything wrong. He's perfect. He doesn't make any mistakes. And he is sent from this other planet. He's sent to Earth to save a race incapable of saving itself. Superman is Jesus, even though he was invented by Jews. Okay? Batman is probably a closer Messiah as far as Jews are concerned. King David. Because why? What's the deal with Batman? I mean, Batman has no supernatural powers. He can't fly. He can't burn steel with his eyes. But he's the Jewish superhero because he uses his human powers to make a difference. He uses his intellect. He uses his detective skills. He uses technology. He's got a lot of money. He uses that too. Okay? And he's also got a dark side. You know, when I was little, I used to hate that, the beginning part of all the Batman movies, but that's really what created him. When he had that terrible experience with all the bats, he watched his parents being killed before him, and he had to be raised by the butler, right? And there's this whole other world that he's in, and he struggles. This childhood trauma with bats, which he has to then turn into his greatest strength. And Batman is doing battle, not with just the bad guys in Gotham. Batman is doing battle here. He's really working on himself. He's really trying to overcome his Yetzirah, his evil inclination. He's mortal. And he teaches us the lesson that we fail, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're a failure. And I think, this is my theory, and you can argue with it if you'd like. My theory is, one of the reasons we feel so awful when we fail at something is because somewhere in the back of our minds, we've internalized this idea that fundamentally we're flawed. That somehow we embrace this on maybe some sort of subconscious level. And it gets triggered when we fail at something. So when I opened up the envelope and I felt that pit in the bottom of my stomach, something much deeper was happening than just the bar. I was tapping into this fundamental disbelief in myself that ultimately I'm a failure. And I just want you to know that there's no Jewish source for this. It doesn't exist. There's no word for this in Jewish vocabulary. And there are no sources that for anywhere in the Torah or in rabbinic tradition of a human being as a failure or a sinner. Failing, yeah. Got a lot of examples of that. Sinning, yeah, big time. What else are we spending all day in Yom Kippur doing? I'm sorry for this, I'm sorry for that. We sin, we fail. But a sinner, failure, very different. And that distinction is incredibly important. And it's fascinating because on the holiest day of the Jewish year, Yom Kippur, when we say the Vidui, you know, you remember that part of the prayers where we clench our fist and we tap our chests and we say, we did this and we did that, Ashamnu Bagada, we literally go through the whole Hebrew alphabet. It's in Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Like, whatever bad could be done, we take responsibility, right? And by the way, I mean, I don't think there's anyone who's that bad that does all of those things. We put it all out there because we always pray in the plural. We take responsibility for everyone. We don't just come to synagogue for ourselves. We ask God for forgiveness for all of us. So we ask We say we're sorry for things we didn't even do because we know someone else may have. But this is so fundamental. Never do we refer to ourselves as sinners or failures. And that's a really fundamental Jewish teaching. And it's the only way, I'll stop speaking in a few minutes and we can open this up for if you have any questions. It's the only way that I can understand one of my favorite rabbinic figures in Jewish history, and that was Rabbi Akiva. I don't know if you guys are familiar, you heard of the great Talmudic sage Rabbi Akiva. He was 40 years old. He's very famous here at MJ also because he was 40 when he started learning about Judaism. He was an illiterate shepherd who fell in love with this woman who believed in him, and she gave up a fortune. Her father was very wealthy, but the father was very against her being with Rabbi Akiva because he was a nobody. And he went off to study, and he became arguably one of the greatest Talmudic scholar that ever lived. And Rabbi Akiva, the way he deals with some of the blows in his life, first of all, he gets a pretty late start, you know. And number two, he loses all of his students in this unexplained, terrible stomach epidemic that ravaged, that's what it says in the Talmud. It says, and we have a mourning period on the Jewish calendar, right after Passover, for the next couple of weeks after Passover, traditional Jews enter into this quasi-mourning period to mourn the loss of the death of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. And why do they die? Talmud tells us that they died because they failed to show respect one to the next. Which is difficult to understand because Rabbi Akiva's championed the rabbinic teaching or the biblical teaching of "Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha," love your neighbor as yourself. Can you imagine championing a verse like that from the Bible, from the Torah, and then losing all of your students because they didn't show respect to one another? They died in some sort of mysterious plague because they failed to show respect. However we understand it, and I'm sure they were evaluated very differently than perhaps we. The way I understand that, just briefly, is that the way, who they were in terms of their relationship with God, very high level spiritual beings, that their inability to relate to other people on that level was lacking in a serious way. But what did Rabbi Akiva do after he sustained the loss of tens of thousands of his students? You know what the Talmud says? On the same page in the Talmud where we learn of this terrible epidemic that took the lives of his students, the Talmud says that he went to the south of Israel and he found five new students. And the Talmud actually lists the names of Rabbi Akiva's new five students and he starts teaching them. He starts all over. And from those five students, rabbinic scholarship is reborn. And Jewish history is continued. If Rabbi Akiva had given up at that time, it is very difficult to understand how Jewish history, at least religious Judaism, could have continued. I'm sure God could have figured out some other way, but just on a normative human level, how does somebody who sustains such a loss, a devastating loss, then just brush off the dust and find more students and just start teaching all over again? And my suggestion is that he realized that he failed, but that he was not a failure, and therefore he could move on. And if we could hold on to that distinction when we fail the next time, I failed, not a failure, you can move on. It helps. And by the way, this isn't just pop psychology. I mean, it is a little pop psychology, but it's not just pop psychology. It's actually considered one of the great principles of the Jewish faith. I want to share one other last idea with you about the Messiah also. Very interesting. And this is a teaching from the late and great Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, one of the great thinkers of the 20th century. He found what's called a stira. Stira is an inner contradiction. Sometimes when you find a contradiction in the biblical text or in a rabbinic source, and you can come up with a resolution. Some of the deepest truths come out of those resolutions, if you can find the conflict. And there's a little of a conflict in the writings of the late and great Maimonides, who lived in the 1100s, great Jewish philosopher, also great physician. And the Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that on one hand, Maimonides wrote that, and there's a debate, but he cited, according to one opinion, that the only way for the Messiah ever to come, but we don't believe the Mashiach has come yet. I mean, look around. But the only way for the Mashiach to come, according to the great Maimonides, is if the Jewish people return in mass to God. Spiritual return. And he makes it very, very clear that that's the opinion in the Talmud that he's siding with. There is another opinion, but he sides with this opinion. It's Rabbi Elezer's opinion in the Gemara and the Talmud. Problem is, the same Maimonides wrote in another treatise, in this 13 Principles of Faith, where he outlined the 13 principles that every Jew is supposed to believe in God and revelation. He says also every Jew needs to believe that the Mashiach is going to come. You have to believe the Mashiach is going to come. And if you don't believe the Messiah is going to come, and you don't anticipate and yearn for its arrival, you cannot consider yourself amongst the traditional Jews, because it's such a fundamental part of being Jewish. And he wrote it in his, what's called Ani Mamins, I believe. I believe in this, I believe in that. And Va'af Pi Shiyitz Mamea, I know the words because it's a big camp song. Very good. Va'af Pi Shiyitz Mamea, and even though it may tarry, even though it's taking a long time, like where's the Mashiach, when's it going to come already? Achakelo, I will wait for it. Bechol Yom, every single day I will yearn, I will anticipate. But here's the problem. How can Maimonides say you have to believe in the coming of the Mashiach to be a good Jew, if he also says that, what, the only way the Mashiach can come is if... is if what? What we just said before. Is if what? Let's get somebody else here. What did we just say? My mom, he said it before. Right, that the Jewish people need to return to God, to His Torah, and to His mitzvot. Let's say the Jewish people don't. Nobody wants to suggest that. But how can Maimonides write both of those things at the same time? Let's say the Jewish people don't return. How then can you believe in the coming of the Mashiach, which Maimonides says is a cornerstone, you know, pillar of faith? So Rabbi Soloveitchik answers, you can't. The only way you can actually believe in the coming of the Messiah is if you believe in the capacity of your own people to live a life of Torah and mitzvot, to come back to Judaism. If you don't believe that, you can't believe in the coming of the Mashiach. Now I know what you're thinking. Do I even believe that? I have a lot of Jewish friends that could care less about their Judaism. They're never going to return. I don't know how close I am to doing that. Like, what's the deal with that? Well, if you doubt this, remember that God commanded us to do a lot of things in the Torah. Actually, to be specific, 613. To love our neighbor as ourself, to observe the Sabbath, to give charity, to keep kosher. You have to ask yourself, why would God have given us all of these laws if He didn't believe us capable of observing them? Was God setting us all up for failure? And I think one of the greatest indications of God's belief in us is that He not only commands us to do these things because He believes they're the best thing for us. You'll have the best life if you observe these laws. If you stay away from these activities and you observe these things, this is the life. I'm telling you, this is what you should do. So that's A. But the implicit, what's happening underneath the surface, is that God thinks we're capable. Right? A teacher never gives a student something if the teacher cares about the student, that the student is incapable of being able to do. And that's why I'm convinced why Jews begin their day by saying the Mode Ani. I actually put it out, I mean, those little cards over there, they're little Mode Ani cards. It's a prayer So first thing we say when we wake up in the morning. And I'll read you the words, and with this I'll end in a minute. It takes me a while to land the plane, sorry. So, Modani Lefanecha. We thank God. Mode means to thank. Thank you, God. Shechazarta Melechai Vekayam, O everlasting King. Shechazarta Binishmati, that you return my soul to me. We have a belief that God gives our souls back to us when we awake in the morning. And but how does the prayer actually end? If you look at the end, let me just grab one of these.
Thank you.
What does it say at the end? The very last two words, we say, "Modeh levin avol chayvim shechazarta b'nishmati," that you have restored my soul within me. Rabba menatecha, great is your faithfulness. Now, the language, I don't know if you could pick up on the Hebrew. We say, Rabba menatecha, great is your faith. Now, who has faith in who, usually? We usually try to have faith in God. We try to believe in God, right? But this is saying the opposite. Rabba emunatecha. The Hebrew means that God is saying, I have faith in you. We start our day by thanking God, by restoring our souls, and by acknowledging that God has faith in us. Now, how do we know that? That's a nice idea. But how do you know, actually, you can answer this question. How do you know that God has faith in you? Without sounding too trite here.
He lets you try again.
He got you up in the morning. Because we believe there's an element of death in sleep. We could have literally just stayed sleeping for a long time. If you wake up in the morning, that's an indication that someone thinks you're capable of doing something worthwhile. Because we don't believe that anyone, any one of us is here incidentally or coincidentally, or we just happen to be. If we're here, it's because we have a task, we have a mission. That's what we're going to discuss next week. And if you get up and you're alive and you're healthy enough to actually carry out your mission in life, then someone believes that you're capable of it. Or else you wouldn't. And by the way, that's one of the things we do when we pray for someone who is ill, God forbid. We never say, look how many great things this person is. A famous story of a child, unfortunately, was very ill. And the mother was praying, and she came to the rabbi, and she's like, you have to remember, when you pray for my son, he's done this, he's done that. No, it's just the opposite. What you want to demonstrate to God is what your son hasn't yet done. What he's still capable of doing, because we're all here for a purpose, we're all here for a mission. And so, as soon as we fulfill that mission, we move on. We pack our bags, or someone else packs them, and we move on to the next phase of human existence. We don't really believe in pure death. Neither did George Harrison, by the way. Just watched an interview of him today. So we don't say great is our faith in you, but we say great is your faith in me. The fact we're given another day demonstrates God's belief. And so when we fail, and we will, we can pick ourselves up and brush off the dust and start over again, because we can know that maybe we weren't successful at something, but that doesn't mean we're a failure. And maybe we've sinned, but that doesn't make us sinners. We do have a Yetzer Hara. We do have a negative inclination of our base physical side. We have inner demons and struggles and challenges. But we also have the Torah as a guide. And we've got role models, like King David or even like a Batman, to inspire us to use our own abilities to overcome our obstacles and to become the people that we were ultimately meant to be. And so I took the bar a third time. And I passed it. And I did, yeah, great. That's what it did me, you know. But just keep that in mind. To succeed, we often have to fail. It's part of what we do. But that doesn't mean we're failures. And I think this is a major, major Jewish teaching that if we can hold on to and think about in the throes of that next failure, or when you're considering the next project, the next relationship, and you're wondering, you don't want to look bad. Because those are the people, I think, who really make it in life. And I don't just mean in a financial sense. The people who take that risk and are not so afraid of what they're going to look like if they get a little mud on their face, if it doesn't work out. You know, how am I going to save face? We're not in this world to save face. We're in this world to do. And you can't do you can't accomplish. You can't push forward. And I think this teaching applies in so many spheres of life. But I'm babbling at this point. Thank you for listening, everybody. Any comments or questions, rebuttals? Please, Jordan.
So I was just thinking about some examples that you gave in terms of Mokiva first with the movie's dimensions.
Yeah.
And then also aspects of triggers for Mashiach to come. Right, and I know that there are beliefs that like Mashiach will come only when the world is on the edge of being like total chaos, right? So I was thinking about that as you were speaking about what you were talking, and then also in terms of the
well, it doesn't have to. There is a belief that the ideal way for the Messiah to come is for you and me, for all of us, to bring it,
right?
To bring ourselves and the world to a higher level of enlightenment, of spiritual enlightenment. So that the world becomes worthy of redemption. If we don't do that, then some speak about this awful situation where God has just waited so long that he just cannot wait for us to bring it anymore. So he brings about some, you know, pretty miserable kind of circumstances and forcing us to kind of choose that path. So, but that's not really the way we want the Mashiach to come.
Right. So I have combining some theories. But also in terms of what Rabbi Akiva did, the death of this being is obviously horrible. So to me, it's almost as if some like what you're talking about, failure, is almost alpha of like one's control of when things go wrong. And if that is the case, is that really failure?
No, there's no... If it's outside of your... I mean, was it outside of my... No, I took responsibility. I knew if I had studied differently and if I had applied myself differently, I probably could have passed the first time. I don't think that was outside of my my abilities. I think if something is outside of your ability, you just say it's in God's hands. There's nothing I can do.
Well, like the like a couple of example of like Rabbi Akiva and all my students, like to say because like he didn't teach.
Well, them I don't know, but how do you not look at yourself? How do you not? How do you as a teacher? You're studying to be a teacher. And if you have all these students, and then they all do, you're not going to ask yourself whether you had something to do with it. Some, maybe you could have taught them differently. Maybe you could have inspired them better. I mean, I think that's a natural thing to do. Now, I think the nice thing about being a religious personality is that when you feel you put your best foot forward, that's it. You're done. In other words, we don't put all of our faith in God and just say, well, you know what? I want to get married one day, but if God really wants me to get married, he'll send Prince Charming or, you know, or the vice versa, you know, along. Or if I was meant to have that job, I'll get the job. But I can, you know, show up 20 minutes late to the interview and look like a schlump and say stupid things. And, I'll, you know, if it was meant to be, it's meant to be. We don't say that either. There's a very delicate balance between what's called in Hebrew, hishtadlut, human initiative, how hard we try, and Chazdei Hashem, God's divine grace. Now, it was above my pay grade to tell you where one starts and the other one ends. Where one ends and the other one starts. You just have to feel, and this is more from a psychological point of view, you've given something your all. And then it's out of your hands. Then it's like up to God. That's why we pray for a good livelihood. So you can work, you can get a great job, get a promotion, and but if God doesn't bless it, it's not going to happen. On the other hand, I don't believe we're going to have what we want blessed if we don't put our best foot forward either. You need a little of both. And that's, you know, but that is, I think, one of, I interviewed Bidi Deutsch for my podcast. You know, she's this amazing runner in Israel. She's literally the fastest runner in Israel today, female runner. And I asked her, like, how she deals with, you know, failure. Like, you know, she's had some amazing successes, but some failures too. And she's like, I'm always okay when I feel I put my best foot forward, I trained, I this, that, and then something happens that's out of my control, there's nothing I can do. That's God's domain. I don't get involved with God's domain. That's Him. She's a big believer. So she's like, you know, because she had lost some big race that she was training for. She says, I did everything that was physically possible to train. It wasn't meant to be. And she was like, really, really okay with it. She goes, that's the best part of being religious, she said. Is that like, I can have that peace at night. Interesting. Yes, I'm not saying everybody who's religious has that peace at night, but she does.
Yeah. Question. I might have missed this before, but how is, like, kind of knowing, and there's, like, this idea about failure to help us know better how to find our mission?
So you have to come next week for that. The reason I put it first tonight is that I think people don't even, because a lot of people do know what they want to do, what they want to accomplish, let's say professionally or just even a hobby, but they don't take that next step and they don't really go for it because they're afraid the more I put myself out there, the more of a fool I'm going to look if I fail. And I'd rather not try. Either because I've been burnt before, I'm embarrassed with other people are going to say, or I'm letting myself down. There's so much psyching out that we do of ourselves. And it's... And by the way, there's no such human being who doesn't go through this. Everybody goes through this. You know, and it doesn't end. It's not like you get to a place in life where like, oh, it's just easy gliding from here. Because you have to constantly reinvent yourself in order to continue to grow. You know, I kept thinking about it. You know, Natasha, we were talking about the Beatles on... So I got to watch last night... it's on Disney Channel.
Get Back.
I thought it was amazing. My wife fell asleep on it, but I thought it was great. And, you know, and I kept thinking, I'm like, I was watching John Lennon and Paul McCartney. They were like working on all this music together. They were like 29 and 27. And I'm like, oh, they were so successful and they had made it already by that age. They were just so, their lives probably, they could just glide. But it's not true because in a couple of years, what worked for you and what helped build you up when you were 25 is not the same thing that's going to help you and build you up when you're 30. You have to still create more or else you start losing it. You know, Paul McCartney's still writing stuff. I mean, that's the greatness of him, I think, not just his talent, but that he's still trying to create new music. So Barry, just to answer your question, like we constantly need this. Even the most successful person in the world needs it.
I didn't realize
the process was
so
good. You didn't read the topics. Huh? I don't know who does. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
Hi, Rabbi. Is there any commentary on what Rabbi Akiva thought about losing all of his students?
No. You know what? We don't really know what was going through his mind. The only thing we know is what he did. What he did was he picked himself up and started teaching all over again. And the thing is, it's pretty true to who he is. He was like a real optimist. You know, anyone who can go at the age of 40 and sit with five-year-olds to learn Hebrew... Seriously, that's what he did. He went to school with five-year-olds, Talmud says this, to learn Hebrew, and just stayed until he became, you know, I'm sure it didn't hurt that he was a genius, but he was not learned at all. He was not educated at all. So he had other obstacles and other things in his life that happened to him, and you see it, you see this personality of just perseverance, resilience, and those are incredibly important virtues to cultivate for success. And I know whenever you hear the word success, it usually means money, but I'm not just talking about success and money, because relationships, in order to have good relationships that last, you need to persevere, and you need to push through, and you need to get through a hard time with your significant other. That's not a simple thing either. And you can feel like a failure and not want to try again. So it really, I think, applies to every aspect of life. But I don't know. I don't know of any commentaries that get us into the mind of Rabbi Akiva. Like, what got him to... I mean, I'll ask you. I've had the honor of knowing some incredible survivors of the Shoah, Holocaust survivors, who lost everything. And just in my capacity, I do a lot of fundraising for the organization, so I've met some older people who came here with nothing. And it's hard sometimes to understand how some of those individuals were such optimists. After losing so much. I'll tell you one quick story. There was a gentleman, Henry Moskowitz, of blessed memory. He learned at the Kollel on the Upper West Side here. So I went to see him when he was 96. He was 102 when he died. And somebody told me to go see him, help us out a little, very successful guy in real estate. He came to this country penniless, lost a wife and a child in the Holocaust. And I was sitting in his living room, and another rabbi from the Upper West Side, European descent, sort of set it up. I didn't really know this person, but we were starting a school at the time, and he thought he could be helpful in us starting the school. And I'm waiting in his living room, and it was a long time ago. It was in the middle of the Second Intifada. And I remember that he had the New York Times on like the coffee table. And I was reading it, and it was a terrible picture on the front page of the New York Times that day of like a wrangled bus in Jerusalem that was bombed by terrorists. And there were like 11 people killed in the incident. And I was waiting a few minutes for him to come out. And by the time he came out, I was all upset. He saw it. And he said to me in his thick Polish accent, he's like, "What's the matter?" And I showed him the article, and he looked at it, he saw the caption, he handed me back the paper, he said, "We never had it so good." I said, "We never had it, Mr. Moskowitz." I said, "There were 11 Jews that were killed. What do you mean we never had it so good?" He says, "Yes, but now we have a government. Now we have an army. Now we can defend ourselves." I will never forget that. And I was so down, and he was so positive. I was like, why? So first of all, he has a little more perspective than I do, okay, for what he's seen. And that's why I always say that if you were born, as all of us were, after the State of Israel was created, we will never appreciate it like people who lived before there was a state, who were alive before there was a state. But he just had that kind of attitude. And I think it's what helped make him successful materially. He became very, very successful in the real estate market in New York City. And he remarried and had a beautiful family. It started all over. And he was always smiling. And the way to go to see him, you can go see him. If he was always learning Talmud in the afternoons at the Kollel here on the Upper West Side. And so I don't know if it's like an innate thing. He's just like born that way or he cultivated it. You know what I mean? Like, but the message I'm trying to leave you with tonight about not seeing yourself as a failure when things go bad, it's setting us back. It's I failed, but that doesn't render you a failure. I can't tell you so much more about the other survivors. They all do seem to have that thread of optimism, almost an innate kind of positive outlook on life, seeing the cup half full and not half empty. That definitely is, and by the way, it is a choice. We sometimes like to think that, like, oh, I wasn't born that way. I was born, I wake up on the wrong side of the bed and I'm a grouch. That's the way God made me. He didn't make me like him. But it is a choice. You can choose to look at the cup half full. And it's a discipline. We're going to talk about that in 2 weeks. How do we discipline ourselves to actually remain positive in the face of adversity? And that is something I think our generation struggles with. Because we have it relatively good, even with all the student loans. It's a good question. Any other comments, questions? Failure? Anybody else want to share failure? I bored my soul to you guys. I'm just kidding. You don't want to do that. All right, so next week we are going to continue. Just like crickets. I want to mention something before we finish. You're all welcome to come on Wednesday night. We're having an open lecture by amazing young woman by the name of Rachel Krauss. We do a Yahrzeit anniversary of the passing of my late mother of blessed memory. And she's going to be our guest speaker this year. She's a community educator on the east side at KJ. Phenomenal teacher, Rachel Krauss. It'll be 8 o'clock this Wednesday night. Her topic is The Hidden Thread. God, I forgot the title. Yeah, what is that? The Hidden Thread of Humanity Found in the Torah. And she's very good. So I would encourage you, if you're around Wednesday night, 8 o'clock. Any other comments, questions, failures? No? No? What's that? Yeah, what else do we got? Please.
I wanted to tell you guys about some events that are happening in MVE. We have Rabbi Wild's the Mother's Memorial, as we talked about.
It's going to be a big event, log before the end of the year. So that's,
yeah, there's chairs in other rooms set up for it.
So then we have a big trip coming up with a ski retreat.
Oh, forgot that. Thank you.
Everyone sign up, beginning of February. Hope everyone wants. We hope to come. Big party. We're going to go out February 3rd through 6th, the weekend there. Sign up online. Check it out. Yeah.
Is there a deadline for that?
Zero deadline. So, the way pricing is going to work, it's going to be cheap as you start.